This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you thought you heard a wide variety of accents from people in North Carolina, you'd be right. Our state is one of the most linguistically diverse states in the nation. English speakers here bring to the conversation a wide variety of regional dialects as well as a collection of ancestral and immigrant languages. And our guests today have been studying this for decades. They have recorded 3,000 or more interviews with people from every corner of the state and have now written a book about what they've found. Talkin' Tar Heel, How Our Voices Tell the Story of North Carolina. It's the work of Walt Wolfram and Jeffrey Reeser. Dr. Wolfram is the William C. Friday Distinguished University Professor at North Carolina State University, where he also directs the North Carolina Language and Life Project. And Dr. Jeffrey Reeser is an Associate Professor of English at NC State, where he contributes to the North Carolina Language and Life Project as well. And they both join us from Durham for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us, Mike.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. How did this state come to be so linguistically diverse, a kind of melting pot of dialects and accents? Why here? Why not South Carolina? Why not Virginia or Tennessee?
Well, there's a number of reasons that North Carolina is a little different than some of the other states. First of all, the different groups of settlers that came here represented a wide variety of different European languages and different English dialects. And Virginia also received a number of those speakers as well. So what made North Carolina a little special was the fact that we were a little bit of a lawless state for a long part of the history. And so we attracted a certain number of people that then found out these isolated places to live around the state. And over time, the geography of the state has really kept many of these groups separate. And so it's a kind of a two-part thing, the first being the settlers and the second being the geography that really gives us this incredible dialect diversity.
And that's why, because of the remoteness of some of these regions and the difficulty of getting from point A to point B, or the blending of certain areas becomes difficult because of the geography, that has maintained some of these linguistic peculiarities longer than perhaps normal?
Yeah, it's a topographically very diverse state, and when that happens, you have a convenient sort of ecological basis for developing different dialects. So you have islands, and people on islands happen to usually are more isolated, or you have people that are difficult to access in the mountains, and that sort of terrain enables the development and maintenance of distinct language varieties.
Is that where most of the distinctiveness resides even today, in the mountains and along the coastline? Or is the Piedmont area of the state and the flatland area of the state also an example of what you're talking about?
Well, I mean, the Piedmont has plenty of language variation itself because topography is only one part of the story.
Right.
Other kinds of developments, you know, cultural movements. So, for example, the Lumbee dialect of Robeson County is one of the most unique dialect situations in the United States. And that was not a matter of terrain. That was a matter of cultural separation and segregation and the development of small pockets of Lumbee Indians in substantive numbers who could maintain and develop a distinct language variety.
Now, as I said, you've been doing this. You've been documenting, collecting, recording conversations with people from various parts of the state with different dialects for decades, literally several decades. You're both linguists. Is this what linguists normally do? or was this project unusual in some way?
Well, we're kind of a special breed. Kind of a special breed of linguists. Actually, I moved here 20-some years ago, and I decided I had been doing this elsewhere for the earlier part of my life, and I decided, you know, North Carolina was relatively untapped and had these wonderful communities, and so why not? And I also understood at that point that people in North Carolina like their state a lot and are very proud of particular traditions. So let's look at the language traditions and make that a source of cultural pride as well. So it was a decision. And Jeff, of course, at that time can speak for himself.
Well, I came to North Carolina not to study the languages, but I got sucked in, and I absolutely love being a part of this project. And I think you know, one of the things that's really interesting about the state is just kind of how these diverse regions all reflect and carry culture and history, and as Walt was saying, how proud these different communities can be of their language. And at the same time, there's often also a little bit of insecurity associated with these Southern dialects, where people are happy that they have that as one of their cultural markers, but they always apologize for it. And so one of the things that we really hope to do here is to celebrate these language differences rather than have them be a source of continuing, you know, insecurity.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit later on, the shame associated with a Southern accent, because it's ludicrous. but anyway, you both of you are involved in NC State University's Language and Life project. I understand the language portion of this. What's the life portion of that project?
Well, the life portion is, as we go around the state and we interview people, you know, we also start realizing that people embrace all of these cultural traits and linguistic traits. And so in a sense, some of our work extends beyond language to simple communities. So, for example, when we work with a community, we try to give something back to that community. Mm-hmm. So we say, well, we're going to mine, you know, the people's voices and go and take them and do instrumental analysis on them and very highly, what can we do for you? And somebody goes, you know, we'd like a history of our community. For example, like in Princeville, the first black community established in the United States. They said, we'd like a history of our community. And our most recent documentary about the Cherokee, which is premiering in Raleigh on November 21st, was basically a request by folks, could you document and help us tell the story of our immersion school? So part of it is not simply isolated language and great voices and great analysis, but part of it is telling the story of people who embody these languages.
Well, you brought up the Cherokees, and I wasn't planning to play this, but we're going to play it now because the documentary that you reference here is not really collecting how they speak English. It's about their language, the revitalization of their own native Cherokee language.
Our language is who we are. Once you start learning the language, it branches out to all other areas, history, culture, traditions. So when they're learning the language, they're learning, you know, everything about the Cherokee people as well.
The Cherokee culture and language will survive because of the great emphasis that has been going on for the last 5 or 6 years. And I think that we are getting to the children at the right time, and that is birth.
That would be the right time from the very beginning, it seems to me.
And in essence, although
Myrtle Driver and Gene Bushyhead are talking in that clip about the revitalization of their own native language, what you're doing by collecting how we speak English in various parts of this state is the same thing, isn't it? Preserving it, documenting it.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we hope to do is to document and preserve. You know, there's all sorts of dialects and language varieties in the state that are passing away or at least becoming less and less visible. You know, along the Outer Banks, for instance, it's really hard to find people who speak the native brogue. And so we are trying to document and preserve these types of cultures. And as they were saying in that clip, you know, this connection between history and language and culture and language is so intimate that it's something that we really think you can't really study and appreciate the cultural markers of North Carolina or the history of North Carolina without also thinking about that language history. And so that's what prompted us to do this dialect awareness curriculum for eighth graders in the state. In eighth grade and in fourth grade, students study the history and culture of North Carolina. And our argument has been you can't understand and study that culture and heritage without really thinking about the language as well.
Since Dr. Wolfram, you are the William Friday Distinguished Professor at NC State University, I thought we would hear from Dr. Friday himself here to talk about a broad spectrum of things very quickly, but also see how this what he's talking about is included in or includes your work here.
We've gone through our period of adolescence as a country. We now know the value of history. We now know why we should preserve buildings and languages and people and traditions, because they become a part of what you really are.
And you, that's how you see language. I know that you consider this diversity of dialects to be a cultural treasure.
It is a cultural treasure, and Bill Friday and I had many conversations about it, and he was so supportive. And so our book is dedicated to the memory of Bill Friday, and there is no greater North Carolinian than Bill Friday in terms of his legacy for the state. And actually, Bill was very sensitive to these sorts of things and very supportive. And with the support of Bill Friday, you, of course, could do things that perhaps you hadn't done before. So I'd like take notes to the producers and say, here, it's a note from Bill Friday. It says, show this film. You know? So Bill was very supportive.
It gets done.
It gets done, yeah. So it's a great legacy to hear Bill and to dedicate this effort to him.
Jeffrey Reeser, how many dialects are there in this state? We've talked about the great diversity. How many are there?
Well, it really depends on how you go about counting them. We talk about there being five major regional dialects in North Carolina, you know, going from the Pamlico Sound dialect region to the Coastal Plain, the Piedmont, the Highlands, and then the northern Piedmont counties really are more like the Virginia Piedmont with their vowel pronunciations especially. But within those regions, there's all sorts of diversity. So Walt mentioned the Lumbee earlier. And we haven't even touched on the sort of regional variation or ethnic variation that happens in these regions as well. Mm. And beyond that, the split between the urban and rural, areas within these regions, say even in the Piedmont, you know, the Charlotte area versus the rural area around Charlotte, that difference is very dramatic, almost if not more dramatic than what we think about as the difference between southern dialects and northern dialects.
And I think there's a difference within Charlotte in the Charlotte metro region itself. If you go from Myers Park to Gaston County or to Fort Mill, there's a difference.
Yeah, no question, no question at all. And so we can think about these kind of big regional dialect areas, and then within them there's these smaller and smaller dialects. And so one answer to this question might just simply be, well, as many people as there are in the state. But you know, what we're trying to do with you know, descriptions of these dialects is think about them in terms of places where there's a lot of similarities, not total similarities, but just a number of similarities. So.
You say that most North Carolinians are unaware of at least half of the language varieties that you talk about in your book. Is that because we don't get out much, or because we don't recognize the subtleties of these various accents because we hear them all the time?
I think it's probably part of both of that, you know, that we sometimes don't get to the places where the rich dialects are because they may not be touristy sites. I mean, Robeson County doesn't get a lot of tourists, and so we don't get there. But also, there are some subtle things that that people take for granted. You know, the pronunciation of vowels that may seem different to an outsider, because the fact of the matter is insiders always give you a perspective that's invaluable. By the same token, outsiders like Jeff and me come and we notice things that perhaps insiders may not know. And so some of the subtle differences may be taken for granted.
That's Dr. Walt Wolfram, who, along with Dr. Jeffrey Reeser, have written a book called Talkin' Tar Heel, How Our Voices Tell the Story of North Carolina. We're just at the very beginning of that story, just scratching the surface of it. We'll delve into more of this in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the 2014 Charlotte Auto Show, featuring hundreds of the 2015 models at the Charlotte Convention Center, November 20th through the 23rd. Tickets at charlotteautoshow.com. Well, whether we work in retail or not, we've all heard the old adage, the customer is always right. Well, not so, says Peter Fader. In fact, he takes it a step further by asserting that only a business's good customers deserve the best treatment. The rest of us, we're just chattel. This all flies in the face of everything, I think, that we all think we know about business and about how we're being treated as customers. But we'll let him explain it to you Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Congress moves to vote on the Keystone XL pipeline, the Supreme Court lifts a stay on gay marriage in Kansas, and the VA announces new plans for improved service.
Join the Diane Rehm Show in the News Roundup from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Walt Wolfram and Dr. Jeffrey Reeser are our guests. Dr. Wolfram is the William Friday Distinguished Professor at North Carolina State University, and Dr. Reeser is an Associate Professor of English. Both of them work together on a project there at the university, the North Carolina Language and Life Project, and they've produced, I think this is your second book together, isn't it, this new book?
We've written a curriculum together. Okay. Jeff was the lead author of that. Yeah, so this is the second book that we've written.
And this book is kind of neat for several reasons. It's really in-depth about the language and the way we speak in North Carolina and why we speak this way. But it also has these, I'm not sure what you call them, but these little
QR codes.
Thank you. QR codes that you put your smartphone up to, and you can hear the dialect that you're writing about. It's right next to the paragraph. Really cool. The book is called Talkin' Tar Heel, How Our Voices Tell the Story of North Carolina. One of you brought up shame about Southern accents, and we have a call about that from Bobby in Charlotte. Bobby, welcome. You're on WFAE.
Well, thank you. My question, I guess, was this. You mentioned earlier about how maybe people shouldn't have shame about it, and I thought, well, that's pretty curious because, would folks listen to a show called Charlotte Talks if they talked a different way, like perhaps I do? And I thought, maybe they wouldn't take it seriously. You may come out of surgery, and the doctor pulls his mask down and says, hey, we got like an embolism, and don't worry, we fixed it up good. I don't know if they carry the same kind of understanding about it,
What about that? That's very true.
And I'll tell you, for example, for me, I'm from Alabama. But when people hear me talk, which is the way I'm talking now, they think, well, wait a minute, where's your accent? If you're from Alabama, how come you don't have a really serious, thick accent? And I tell them, well, I just don't.
What would a really thick Alabama accent sound like?
Probably about as thick as I'm talking right now. But, of course, in the same way in North Carolina, it's going to depend on where you are. If you're in northern Alabama or southern Alabama, mm-hmm. or Tuscaloosa or Fort Payne, it's going to be pretty thick.
Okay. What about that? He brings up an interesting point that maybe you shouldn't be ashamed of your accent, but it may hold you back. I early in my career here, I came from the D.C. area, and where I grew up living in the D.C. area, there were no accents. But if you went 30 minutes in either direction, there were. You either got to the Baltimore, Maryland kind of accent, which I can't do, or you got to a kind of a southern drawly accent in Fairfax County. But when I moved here, people said, where's your accent? And then they said, well, I have an accent. I guess I can't be in radio because I have an accent, and nobody in broadcasting has accents. And I said, have you ever been to New York City? Listen to people on the radio in New York City, and they all have these really northern New York accents. Why should you lose your southern accent if you're going to be on the radio in South Carolina? How silly is that? So talk about that. Why, these things hold you back, don't they?
Well, they certainly have the potential to. One of the things that we try to educate people about is the fact that you can't speak English without speaking a dialect of English. So everybody has to have an accent. Some are just more noticeable than others. And we do have all sorts of correlations that we make between certain dialects and our expectations of what people are able to do well and not do well. And so, for instance, there's the famous Jeff Foxworthy jokes about you don't want your brain surgeon to have a southern accent. But the truth of the matter is the accent has absolutely nothing to do with people's ability to do X, Y, or Z. And so these correlations are things that are not linguistically based. And that's really what we're trying to put forth in the book here is your ability to do things, your intelligence level, have nothing to do with any sort of dialect. And so you can think about other people who are, throughout history. You mentioned newscasters. There's been newscasters, prominent newscasters nationally, who have very strong regional accents.
Well, Bob Schieffer on CBS has a southern
accent. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so there's all sorts of examples like that where that particular accent does not cause any sort of problems.
As a matter of fact, if you watch some of the advertisements for cars during the news programs in the evening,
but they're local,
you'll hear distinct, very locals, because actually, would you rather buy your car from a Yankee talking salesperson who may not be trustworthy, or a person who talks like you that you can trust? So actually,
well, you've made a leap there. what about somebody who talks like you who you also can't trust?
Well, they're more devious. Let's face it. If you're buying a German or a Japanese car, an accent is an advantage, because there is an assumption that this person must be a great mechanic, which is totally spurious. But you know, that's the assumption that we make. So what we're trying to do is really educate people to dissociate feelings of intelligence and competence from how you speak a language variety. You know, Sam Irvin from the Watergate hearings, I mean, he was a brilliant, brilliant person and a fine rhetorician, and he spoke in a good Southern boy accent.
You know, when The Sopranos was on television, you could watch The Sopranos, and you would hear this really thick New Jersey accent by some of the characters who were in the mob, and you'd think they're not the brightest bulb in the chandelier. But more often, when movies and Hollywood and television shows portray characters from the South, they give them these really thick Southern accents, and they really do sound like dimwits. But you have recorded a conversation with a woman who has a different take on the Southern accent. Let's hear from her, and you can talk about what she says and about her accents.
And these Northerners come down here, and we take them in, and before you know it, it ain't the same. It's really not. They don't think and act like we do. Well, they sure don't talk like us. They have a sharpness to their speech. Don't you think so?
Yeah.
Most Southerners and all, I mean, I feel like we have kind of a soft melody. Of course, why shouldn't I think it? I don't know any different.
That's Martha Pearl Villas. Place her accent for us.
She's representative of that old-time Charlotte accent that's really getting more and more difficult to hear every year.
And it was more associated with sort of aristocracy, the Arlises and so forth, actually of her era, and even of New York City before World War II, mm-hmm. was associated with prestige, not stigma. And over since World War II, it's sort of become in the South a more rural phenomenon, and in, say, even like New York City, a more stigmatized working class association, which shows you how arbitrary language is in terms of the connotations that it picks up. It simply follows the people and takes on the associations with the people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you watch old movies from the 30s and 40s, well, first of all, they've all taken elocution lessons for the theater, and for theater where there was no microphone, so they all speak with a peculiar sound that doesn't exist anymore. But many of them have these very northern, mid-Atlantic patrician accents. So would Martha's accent be kind of a southern patrician accent of its time?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you can listen to her and. I think it evokes kind of an old-time mm-hmm. Southern aristocracy.
Where's that going? Is that going away?
Yeah, I mean that's an accent that's really difficult to hear in younger generations. That's not to say there's not, you know, urban Southern features in accents today. It's just those urban Southern accents are quite different than the older versions of those. You can think about certain things that happen in the cities, mm-hmm. you know, certain vowel pronunciations, especially that do mark people as being Southern, including even, you know, certain grammatical things, the use of you know, kind of some older phrases that kind of index that Southern heritage.
Like
at the same, things like fixin' to, which we think about it as more rural than urban, but still used in urban areas.
I'm fixin' to go to the store.
Like, Yep. Yeah. The use of something like cut on for or mash for turning the light switch on.
Or someone favoring their appearance and so forth. And actually, in terms of language change, the metropolitan areas of North Carolina are where it's at in terms of how they change. You know, we have some of our staff studying Raleigh speech, and you have people at UNC Charlotte like Becky Roeder and Boyd Davis who have been looking at the change in the Charlottean community, which is dramatic over generations. So Martha Pearl Villas certainly represents a quite older and now rare form of aristocratic Charlottean speech.
So when you hear a Southerner say that water is as smooth as paper, that's all gone? Andrew emails, I have recently moved here, Charlotte, from the New England area. Never have I, with such frequency, been asked where I'm from. I notice how quickly I talk in comparison to longstanding citizens of the area. I also get a lot of mm-hmm and a look of, in a deep Southern accent, this fool is talking so fast I can't understand a word he's saying. What about the tempo of our speech?
Well, Andrew, bless your heart. Welcome to North Carolina. The perception is that that the Southern speech varieties are slower. You know, we think about the drawl and how that slows down the speech variety compared to Northern varieties. The research is a little bit messier. You know, within Northern varieties and within Southern varieties, there's so much difference from speaker to speaker that, generally speaking, you could say that you know, the South has a little bit slower speech than the North, but there's actually more overlap than there is distinction between that. And so it is certainly something that's noticeable, but it's not the sort of thing that's at all universal.
You just used a phrase that is illustrative of some of the things that you write about in your book, where people say things where you say things you don't mean. Bless your heart is one of those things. And I think, is that peculiarly Southern, where you say, well, bless your heart, and that means you poor child, or boy, are you off track. But, it doesn't mean at all what it says.
Well, it can be used, you know, by some older people as a compliment. So if a little grandchild comes around, you know, and says something, and a grandmother or grandfather says, bless your heart, you're so sweet. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's often used as one of those indirect flatteries of sort of disagreement. That kid is so stupid, bless his heart. So there is a sort of wide continuum of meanings and uses. So be careful of the context in which it's used, because you may be being dismissed to being complimented.
One last thing in response to Andrew's question. One of the things that's really fascinating about, you know, we have a section of the book on Yankee speech in the South. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's really fascinating is how many people share stories exactly like Andrew's, where, you know, you come to the South, people ask where you're from. You can't, you know, necessarily communicate as well initially. And it doesn't take too long until you make that phone call home and somebody says, wow, you really sound Southern.
Yes.
And so I hope Andrew will share that story with us sometime about how long it takes him before people back home in New England tell him he sounds Southern.
Well, you know, I've heard people say that, and I don't know if this is true or not, but you're the linguist, you can tell me, that the Southern accent is closest to what the British accent might have been during the colonial period. But if that were true, why wouldn't the Boston accent be equally, wouldn't it? Why wouldn't it be similar? Because they all came from the same place as well.
Well, it's certainly true that that modern Southern is more similar to modern British than any other American dialect. And so it's kind of interesting. You know, we think about, you know, British dialects as being prestige dialects and the Southern dialect as being a stigmatized dialect often, but they actually have a lot of things in common. And so it again shows just kind of how arbitrary these decisions are about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And in terms of Boston specifically, you know, it's a city that's received, again, all sorts of different settlers. And within the city, you have tremendous differences in dialect. you know, the perception from the outside is often that everybody says, you know, Pak the Ka the same way. But of course, within the city, you get all sorts of differences. And there's been all sorts of language change. You know, language never stands still. There's no place in the world where people are still speaking the way that people spoke 300 or so years ago. You know, the thing is, most of the stuff is the same. You know, so you look at the words and things like that. We get more in, but the vast majority of our words, we've been using the same types of things for forever. And so we do notice the differences oftentimes a lot more than the things that stay the same.
You know, we get a lot of flack from some quarters around the country for saying y'all come over. But then in Philadelphia, they say use.
I'm from Philadelphia.
Okay.
Yeah.
And John says, can you mention the mountain dialect in which they say Ewens?
Yeah. Actually, you know, here's the story of y'all. Basically, because of the history, the singular you and the plural you addressing more than one person have become fused. So it's one you. So we have, you know, a plural for I and we. So there was a hole in the pattern. And everybody tries to make that pattern regular. So, for example, in the north and places like Philadelphia, we have yous, we have you guys. And then they have Yuns, all right, which goes from Pittsburgh down to the Smoky Mountains as just another way of filling that. Mm-hmm. And then in other parts of the South, we have y'all, which really accentuated after the Civil War. There were tokens of you all around, but it really elided into y'all and accentuated. So this is a natural process that every English variety has to fill this gap for second person plural. And the South has done it in a very symbolic and iconic way that becomes associated with Southern speech, just as yous or yuns becomes associated with the Smoky Mountains in Pittsburgh.
Okay. Let's see if we can bring in a couple of other things that have come in here as we've been talking. Peggy, I noticed down here people say put up as putting something away in the pantry. I'm going to put up the peaches. Is that peculiar to this state or to the South in general?
I don't think it's particularly unique to the South. And I mean, it does have regional distribution, but I recall putting up in southeastern Pennsylvania. So a lot of these items sort of have pockets of regionality that include the South, but are not necessarily exclusive of other regions.
We're talking about language and dialects, particularly within the Tar Heel State, because we have the greatest diversity of dialects in the country, evidently, according to our guest today, Dr. Walt Wolfram and Dr. Jeffrey Reeser. They both together worked on a book called Talkin' Tar Heel, How Our Voices Tell the Story of North Carolina. And we have a lot more to tell when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, presenting British Invasion, an exhibition showcasing the museum's holdings of artwork created by artists from Great Britain. Works include lithographs, drawings, sculpture, and paintings, and details are at beckler.org. It's Friday, the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, the National Hour, first at 10. Congress moves to vote on the Keystone XL pipeline. The Supreme Court lifts a stay on gay marriage in Kansas. And the United States Department of Veteran Affairs offers new plans for improved service. A panel of journalists joined Diane to talk about the national stories at 10, the international stories at 11. And if you'd like to join our conversation about language and accents and dialects, linguistics, Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org. We'll get you to us, as will searching for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we are coming right back.
Hello, I'm Renee Montaigne with NPR. And if you happen to think because there are millions of listeners to public radio, you don't make a difference, think again. When you become a contributor to WFAE, you make a huge difference to the station and the community. It doesn't take much. All contributions are welcome because you're helping to pay for the program that matters to all of you. Make an impact on your community today by contributing online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Walt Wolfram and Dr. Jeffrey Reese are both professors of linguistics at North Carolina State University are our guests, and they have written Talkin' Tar Heel, How Our Voices Tell the Story of North Carolina. And as I mentioned coming out of the last break, it's really very cool if you have a smartphone, because as you read through this and they start writing about various dialects and accents and you want to hear what they're talking about, all you do is aim your smartphone at the QR code. What are they called again? The QR codes?
The QR code, yeah.
Next to the paragraph, and you can get it. It links you right into a recording of that in some cases. One way that you can distinguish, this is everywhere, in any part of the country, one way you can distinguish locals from outsiders is how they pronounce some of the places in the state in which you are. And you have a list in your book of some key places, some of which, I got to tell you, I was unable to even hazard a guess at. And I have lived here for a long, long time. So let's hear what some people who aren't from here came up with on this list.
Manteo, Buis Creek.
Ahoski.
Pasquotank.
Tuskegee, Corolla.
Bodie Lighthouse, Conetove,
Fuqua Varina, Robeson County, Birdie, Rowan,
Kerr Lake, Chowan,
Tyrell County, Rodenthee,
Lake Waccamaw,
Hatteras,
Rotis,
Arokakoke,
Nantahala,
Albemarle,
Durali,
Storatown,
Bethabara,
Chickamaucomico,
Cabarrus, Cashew River,
Iredell,
Uari,
Saxapaha.
You can always tell that's a weatherman on television from out of state when they first hit Cabarrus County and they say Cabarrus like they did. So now here are the locals correctly pronouncing all of those various places.
Manio, Buis Creek.
Ahoski, Pasquotank.
Tuckasegee, Corolla.
Body Lighthouse.
Kaneda.
Fuqua Varina, Robeson County.
Bertie, Rowan.
Carr Lake. Chowan,
Terrell County, Rodanthe,
Lake Waccamaw, Hatteras,
Rodheus, Ocracoke,
Nantahala, Albemarle,
Duralay, Sauertown,
Bethabara,
Chickamaucomico, Cabarrus, Cashai River,
Iredell,
Uari,
Saxapaha.
So what does collecting examples like this tell you as linguists?
Well, it tells us that that there's a lot of difficult place names in North Carolina. And, you know, the reason for those difficult place names is just that there's so many different linguistic traditions that are caught up in the local pronunciations, from American Indian languages to, German to different dialects of English that had different stress patterns than what we're used to today, things like Bodie versus Body and these little differences like that. It really points to this incredible diverse history that North Carolina has in terms of all the different language varieties that came here.
Yeah. There are also some words that apparently are native to North Carolina because I've never even heard them used even within the state, and I've lived here a long time. Words like Buddy Row, if that's how you say it, Juvember, Cygoglin. Right. What do they mean? Where did they come from? And tell me more.
Okay, Buddy Row is just a regional term. Probably it extends from some sort of metaphor from gardening. You know, the buddy rows, and we don't know exactly the etymology, but that's actually fairly widespread around different regions of North Carolina. And then,
in fact, I think you get that term almost all the way up to Washington, D.C. historically.
Never heard it in my life. Never.
Yeah.
I guess I don't get that.
Maybe you've never been somebody's good friend.
Maybe that could be.
it certainly has more of a rural distribution now than it used to.
What about Juvember? What is that?
Juvember is a word that the Lummi use to describe a slingshot, and it's one of those that is found only in that particular area. And it's one of those terms that we just we really don't know much about its history. We can't quite figure out where it comes from. So it's an unsolved linguistic mystery.
All right. And
except that we know people have lots of hypotheses when you go out in the street and say, hey, what's a Juvember? And somebody says, oh, it's a cold snap in July or something like that.
What about Cygoglin, if I'm saying it correctly?
Cygoglin means crooked, and there's all sorts of different words for it in different dialects. You know, you get cattywampus, you get whopperjod in the eastern part of the state. Antigoglin is another version of it that's found all the way up to Pittsburgh. And so, these are just regional terms that have, again, these longstanding histories, and they've fallen out of use in a lot of the other areas. So most of these terms, Cygoglin and Buddy Row, you used to be able to hear in more of the urban areas of the state, but they're more restricted now to the rural areas. Cygoglin we hear especially in the mountains.
And another word that you bring up that is pretty North Carolina, according to you, if I read it correctly, I've always associated with Archie Bunker on All in the Family, who called his wife Edith a dingbat. But in North Carolina, dingbatter has another meaning. What is it? Where is it from? Why?
Well, strange as you should mention Archie Bunker, because people on Ocracoke and the Outer Banks got that term from Archie Bunker. We can document when it came in. It came in when All in the Family was televised on the Outer Banks. They got television access, and that was one of the shows. And up until that time, they'd used for outsiders terms like foreigner and stranger and woodser, that is a person where there's a lot of woods. And then they saw how Archie Bunker called his wife Edith a dingbat because she lacked common sense. And there are a lot of people who go to these islands who lack common sense in terms of how they drive on the sand, in terms of how they fish. And so they appropriated that term or reappropriated it to the term for outsiders. So dingbatter is simply a term for an outsider thanks to Archie Bunker. The younger kids who've not seen Archie Bunker have made a new term, because all communities like this seem to want to have terms that distinguish insiders and outsiders. But the current generation of people on Ocracoke, for example, calls outsiders Torons, which is a blend of a
yes.
tourist and a moron.
A moron, yeah.
So you can see our status.
Yes. So Dennis emailed something about the Outer Banks. The Outer Banks seems to be a great place to be a linguist and study what's going on. He says, my favorite dialect is often called high tide or hoitoid, heard on part of the Outer Banks. I hear it at Cedar Island, where you can ferry to Ocracoke. It sounds almost Elizabethan. Can your guests elaborate?
Yeah, it I think does evoke that Elizabethan sense for a lot of people, and there's a lot of mythology built around that concept that somehow this language is this pure preservation of this older form. But as Walt was just saying with the term dingbatter and the more recent Turon, you know, the language continues to evolve, continues to change, and that dialect used to be a lot more widespread. You used to be able to hear it all the way up into the Chesapeake Bay area, and it's since become more and more restricted. To the point now where some communities have lost it entirely. So Hatteras, or Hatteras as the locals used to call it, it's really hard to find people with that brogue or that hoitoiter accent. In some of the more isolated communities, especially down east North Carolina, and also in places like Ocracoke, where you have to take the ferry to get there, you still have some people, especially those who are connected to that traditional lifestyle, who embrace that particular variety. It's very distinctive. That hoitoid vowel is the most distinctive vowel associated with it, but it's not the only distinctive aspect of it.
Actually, I want to play an example of this Outer Banks brogue. You called it one of the United States' most distinctive dialects, and you recorded a guy named Rex O'Neill, who I think, if I understand this correctly, is a fisherman, and he entertains tourists by waxing poetic in this brogue, and here it is.
That's right. As he cleans the fish, he entertains them with his language.
Okay, here it is.
Came out there, I said, I'm studying speech. I said, well, it's hoitoid on a sound soy. Last night the waterfall, night moonshine, no fish.
No fish.
What do you suppose it matter, like a woods?
You know, when he says moonshine, that sounds a little Philadelphia to me. or Maryland, Maryland Eastern Shore. Maybe that's because it went up the shore. But talk about that brogue, because brogue in Irish means twisted tongue.
Right. And it is a term that is sometimes used for language varieties that are very different to outsiders. So particularly on the Outer Banks, that's what they call it, the hoitoi brogue. Mm-hmm. It actually, while it does retain some things of older English, here's one of the most interesting things about it. It's the one dialect in the United States that people don't think is from North America. So people will constantly say, are you Australian? Are you British? And even people in England, because we've had one of the British dialectologists take samples from the Outer Banks and play it for people in Essex. Mm-hmm. And none of them identified that brogue as being from North America. They all found it to be somewhere in Southwest England, where they pronounce their R's and so forth, like Durban and so forth.
And you talked
it's really unique.
You talked to one lady from that part of the state who said that she has, I guess, wiped that out of her speech pattern, the hoitoid brogue, because she says it doesn't sound ladylike, really.
Yeah. Well, that has an interesting history. Older speakers, there's no gender distinction. Mm-hmm. But as as the middle-aged people developed their economy and the dialect was receding, middle-aged and younger men took it as a token that symbolizes a traditional fisherman style. And so it became much more associated with this rugged image of the classic fishermen of that area, and therefore became much less gendered. So it's interesting that that younger boys and middle-aged men will use it much more than women, when it was once used by everyone.
You spoke with Dr. Boyd Davis from UNC Charlotte. She's also a linguist who has a special way of teaching her students about the impact of accents. Let's hear from her.
I play a game when I'm working with students. I ask them to lower their eyes for a second and pretend they can't see me. Pretend I'm behind a screen. And they're listening to me talk. And as they hear me talk, they can hear that I have a number of Southern features that they associate with upper or middle class in my voice, with the R's, the A's, and the G's. They'll hear that it's sort of Southern, but I talk too fast to be Deep South. I don't have that soft spread on bread from Savannah or some of the areas around in there. You can hear that I'm over 18, I've lost that beautiful breathless quality, that I am, we hope, under 80 because it's not thoroughly cracked. You can hear that I probably like the situation. I have some education. I like the speaker, and if you listen for another minute, you can hear me smile at you. You give away all of that every time you say anything. That's what an accent tells you.
And you say these accents tell us about our history and our culture, but what do you have to know to make that connection between accent and history?
Well, I think to make the connection between accent and history is it requires a little bit of digging into this history, appreciation of the culture, kind of this understanding that people speak the way they do because of this inherited past and because of their imagined future. And bridging that into what Boyd Davis was saying here, all those things about our past do shape our current, you know, our demographics, our current ideas, our current presentations of ourselves in the world. And so our language really captures all of those things about who we are, where we came from, and really about who we are in terms of how we project ourselves into the future.
Just to show
and
you,
that's what we think is so fascinating about this.
Just to show you our listeners, the wide variety of accents. We just heard the little brogue from the Eastern
Rex
Shore.
O'Neill.
Yeah, Rex O'Neill. Let's go to the other side of the state. Let's go to the high country, to the mountains, and play an example of mountain talk. If outsiders heard this, they might leap to a lot of different conclusions about the speaker. So let's hear it, and then I want you to tell us what this speech pattern tells you.
Talking about like that, like if you had some wood out in the yard,
instead of saying carry it in the house, she'd say tote it in the house. And like if you had something that you wanted to put in a paper bag, you put in a paper poke, you know, instead of a paper bag. Well, the way people talk around here, I guess it'd be what more like you call hillbilly style or something, I guess. I don't know, just mountain talk.
Most of your local people have your mountain talk. That's the way you can tell the mountain people from your outsiders by their language they use. Say, I'll see you over yonder. That means I'll see you like in Waynesville. It's a mountaintop kind of. Well,
never, nothing stops. It's like a singing, you know. We're kind of like we're singing. Lita said we're singing, not talking, you know.
So what does that tell you? And do they maintain that accent so they can be clearly identified as people who belong in that place?
Yeah, well, the first person you heard there is sort of the infamous Popcorn Sutton, the famous moonshiner who is going to be inducted into the Georgia Moonshine Hall of Fame. So, yes, he's embraced and turned that character into a positive image. So hillbilly is a typically pejorative term. Mm-hmm. You'll see he proudly embraces that, which in a sense is what we want people of North Carolina to do, to embrace their variety and see it as a part of the heritage that includes great writers, great artists, great poets, and great film producers, to include language in what North Carolina is.
And we've just scratched the surface. More in the book, Talkin' Tar Heel, How Our Voices Tell the Story of North Carolina, by our two guests today, Dr. Walt Wolfram and Dr. Jeffrey Reeser from North Carolina State University. Thanks for the hour.